Hey, this is Michael Kaz, and on this podcast, I explore ways of living a more wholehearted and fulfilling life. I believe in the saying that what is most personal is most universal. On this podcast, you will hear personal stories of struggle and challenge and what I and my guests have learned from those experiences. You will hear ideas and concepts that expand your mind on topics like personal development, health, adventure, and sex and relationships. Above all, my intention is to bring a depth of conversation and stories to connect more with my guests and with you. This episode is brought to you by Organifi. Organifi is a line of organic superfood blends that offer plant-based nutrition made with high-quality ingredients. Each of their blends is science-backed to craft the most effective doses with ingredients that are organic, free of fillers, and have less than 3 grams of sugar per serving. The one that I use most consistently is their green juice. It has essential superfoods and a clinical dose of ashwagandha, which is a very powerful mushroom, not the magical kind. It helps reduce stress, support healthy cortisol levels, and overall, I just feel like I'm being a healthy human when I take this. And it's also the tastiest green drink that I've ever tasted. In college, I started drinking these, and I remember drinking things with spirulina and having to hold my nose. This is quite different. It's delicious. They also have Organifi Gold, a superfood tea that supports rest and relaxation, so you can wake up feeling refreshed. Each of their blends is super easy to use. You just mix it with water or any other beverage that you like, and they don't compromise quality for taste. They take pride in offering the best tasting superfood products on the market at a price that works out to less than $3 a day. You can experience all of these high quality superfood products without breaking the bank. Go to Organifi.com/Kaz, C-A-Z, and use code Kaz for 20% off your entire order. That's www.organifi.com/CAZ and use code CAZ at your checkout to get 20% off your entire order. Hey, and welcome to the show. Today, I'm talking with a good friend of mine named Lauren Walsh. She's the founder of a company called The Global Sisterhood, which focuses on facilitating deep transformational discussions for women. They also train others in how to facilitate these groups. In today's episode, we talk about how you can host and facilitate your own discussions in your family, in your group of friends, in your community, in your business, both from a facilitator standpoint as well as someone who is speaking or just listening in a group. With that, let's welcome Lauren Walsh. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
It's great to be here with you.
Great to be here with you.
Let's start out with how you came to devoting the last several years of your life to leading groups of women, having discussions in a circle. Your company has now sparked over 15,000 really deep, meaningful, oftentimes spiritual conversations among women. How did you come to devote your life to that? Devote the last several years to that?
I think it was because I felt like I didn't belong. I think I felt weird and that this world wasn't quite designed for people like me. I grew up with lots of trauma. And if you know anything about trauma, especially as a child, you can like split yourself, you can disassociate, and then you go to school and you're trying to learn math and you're trying to socialize and you're trying to learn how to spell, and that can be harder because a little part of your psyche is trying to process everything that's going on at home. And that was me. And I didn't have high self-esteem in one sense because I didn't perform well in the standard ways that we're asked to perform. And I had emotional needs that were unable to be met. And so I sought to meet those needs in other ways, through relationships, through friendships, and was unsuccessful, actually, like in middle school, high school, you know how it is. It's hard to have like real, deep, honest conversations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost non-existent. At least I never saw meaningful conversations happening. I never had any growing up.
Right.
For sure.
Right. I needed that. I needed somebody to listen to me and say, I still like you, even though you have all this stuff going on inside. And I didn't know that I needed that, but I still need that. And so I was in high school, actually, and I took a psychedelic. Can I say that on this podcast?
You can say it.
Right. Okay.
So what's a psychedelic?
Well, it wasn't an actual psychedelic. It was MDMA, but it was ecstasy at the time. It was before I knew about a better compound. And actually mushrooms too. This happened on mushrooms too. And I would do this while my parents were asleep, and I would invite friends over. And I was so amazed about what happened, because people started talking. Mm. People started having real conversations, and then people would get silly, and I'd be like, no. Back to the real conversation. So I started sitting people in circles and guiding them through exercises.
Wow. How old were you?
15, 16, 17. Mm-hmm. And I used to have all these different ideas that would come to mind. Like, one, we would all work on a collaborative drawing. We would like all draw the same painting, and then we'd analyze it, and then we'd all do like collective poems. Like, I would do a line and somebody else would do a line. And there'd always be that one really annoying person that would like mess it up. Mm-hmm. But it would get really deep and really real.
Hmm.
And what I noticed, though, unfortunately, at that age, after the drugs wore off, people would put their masks back on and I would feel lonely again. And so I then went into like wanting to drink a lot and wanting to, you know, heal my anxiety and do all those things by overusing substances, which did me no good. And I found myself in all these manifestations of the trauma from my childhood until I had...
Like what? What does that mean?
Like, so I grew up with a parent that was an alcoholic and a drug addict as well. And so I reached for partners, boys, that had similar type of dispositions, had a deep wound, and therefore we'd have like a trauma bond, and we'd have really hard relationships, really dramatic, sometimes even abusive. I was really abusive to myself. I was like your quintessential girl that wore this like tough exterior and was always smiling and was acting cool, but inside was like screaming and staring at myself in the mirror, judging my body, hating the way I looked, hating who I was. And so that didn't really make for good decisions. But I was always a seeker. And I was always spiritual, and I looked in religions and I looked in different spiritual practices, and I had a hard time finding myself in Christianity. Although early in life, I really connected to it. I was like, oh yes, this feels amazing. I loved it. I loved the idea of the Virgin Mother too, just this like goddess energy, this queen of heaven. But then when I started listening in church, I was like, I don't see myself represented here. I don't feel the feminine is represented here at all. Actually, I feel like it's really suppressed. And so I went seeking. So I was a seeker on one level. I was like always writing poetry, always trying to bring people together. I was trying to heal myself on one level. But then on this other level that I couldn't control, I was self-destructing. And I had this moment when I was 21 years old where I call like a divine intervention. I had an opportunity for me to shift my life completely and really completely dismantle everything. Have like one of those kinds of spiritual awakenings where like everything you thought you knew completely is shaken up, and you go through a really deep passage of transformation. And I had a moment like that and then devoted myself to my healing. And that lasted about 7 years of like, I didn't have your normal life of a 20-year-old. I call it my nun phase. Like during that time when people play like popular music, I don't even know what it is. Like I've never heard it before. I was inward, deep, devoted, working with teachers, studying different modalities, and really it was life or death for me. But in that process of being so focused on healing my wounds, I would have these really great encounters with other women and also teenage girls. And something in me would be like, oh, I want to connect with this person. I could see that they were embodying some type of wound that perhaps I had embodied, or like they were going through something that I had just gone through. And so I just went and I would share with them like, oh, this is what I'm learning. And as I would open myself up to be of service with just total pure intentions, I noticed that I began to channel wisdom that was greater than me, wisdom that didn't just come from me. Wisdom that was coming through me from something higher. And it was a message for this person, but it was also a message for me. And so when I would show up to serve others, my growth was amplified. And then that led to really amazing relationships with women, like deep sisterhood. Like, we're here on a spiritual journey, taking off our masks, saying like, hey, it's okay that you feel shame. It's okay that you don't like that aspect of yourself. It's okay that you have this skeleton in the closet. I have that too. I have that too. And I see your light and we're good. Let's grow together. And we would do ritual together. We would do practice together. We would walk spiritual path together. And that led me to leading women's circles. Intuitively, I didn't really know what they were. I just intuitively was like, we should gather on the moon and, you know, do this stuff and pray and sing and connect. And I didn't really know that was a thing because back then women's circles weren't as well known. And that led me to Global Sisterhood, where we've now, like you said, helped seed over 15,000 women's circles worldwide.
So cool. So while you were in your nun phase, I was in a similar phase, 18 to 24-ish, where I was completely sober. I was in recovery. And I don't think I went to a single party in college. I had a very different experience. Right. And I was having a lot of very intense, deep discussions. Yeah, walking a very similar path. I was also working with a lot of other alcoholics trying to help them get healthy. So very, very similar.
Ah, I see you. Cool.
Do you feel comfortable sharing about the spiritual awakening?
Yes, certain things about it. Mm-hmm. I feel comfortable. So I think spiritual awakenings often happen, and I guess they can happen whenever, but for me, it happened at my darkest moment. I was in a really classic abusive relationship. And I always thought I was stronger than that. Like, I'm vivacious and powerful and strong-willed. I never imagined that I would be in a situation where I had lost all sense of my power. Mm. And more than that, it was almost like I gave my power to him willingly. It's a really complicated thing, abusive relationships, because I don't blame him fully. I blame myself, but I also blame, like, he had a really hard life. And so in that dynamic, there was a power dynamic, and he was like, he could see what I hated about myself and he used it. And I basically felt like nobody else would ever love me. And I just basically enslaved myself to him no matter what, and didn't stand up for myself and was really submissive. And so I was in this situation, and I made a cry for help. So it was New Year's Day, and we didn't go out on New Year's Eve because we knew that if we went out and we partied, bad things would happen. Because when he was sober, he was beautiful. Like, I saw who he was. And so we didn't do anything that day, but New Year's Day, we went to a friend's house, and I fell asleep on the couch. And he was drinking, and he woke me up, and it was just us and our other friend. And he woke me up real sweetly and was like, come on, baby, wake up, let's go. And he brought me to the car, opened the car door for me, shut it, was really sweet. And then as soon as he got in, away from our friend, started tearing me down, calling me a slut, telling all these different things. And I snapped, like, something inside of me, like, rageful, crazy, maddening, collie energy reached out from inside this, like, submissive, scared girl and screamed at the top of my lungs, grabbed the steering wheel from the passenger seat, yanked it real hard while we're driving in Los Angeles on La Brea Avenue. And we crashed into 6 parked cars. And it was, like, super theatrical. And we went to the hospital, and I remember faking my injury so that I could get away from him because I was scared. And it was one of those, like, really low moments where I called my mother and I was like, Mom, and I was finally ready to admit that I was in a bad situation. And I was like, Mom, you got to help me. And poor thing had been trying to help me, and on the other line, I just felt this woman who had loved me and been my champion, afraid that there was no going back for me. And it was like this really scary moment of like, did I lose everyone who ever believed in me? And also, anyway, I won't go into the details of that, but anyway, super, super low moment. And my family got together and they had an intervention for me. So I'm the youngest by a lot. And so we grew up in this, you know, we call before 2008 the dark ages. We were all traumatized. We were dealing with some ancestral karma. It was really hard. We weren't connected. We were all doing our own things to survive. My issue, plus a few things that have been happening with my brothers before, brought us together. So my siblings came and they had an intervention with me, and which led me to going to the Amazon rainforest. And I was in the Amazon rainforest in 2008, and I was so like, what is going on? How am I here? And I noticed many things, many, many things, and experienced many different things and participated in different rituals there that totally changed my life. Like, totally gave me a clearer vision of who I am and what had happened to me and how I had lost my light, but I was able and capable to get it back if I worked hard. And that was really my awakening.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing all of that. Mm-hmm. And it's so special that it brought your entire family closer together. And now I know a little bit about your family and how conscious and self-aware and healthy everyone is. And your experience was such a huge part of that. That's amazing. Yeah,
my brother too. I had a brother. We both manifested the family wound pretty strong. And he had his spiritual awakening before me. And it was really what led me to the Amazon. He was really my invitation to wake up.
You talk about female competitiveness some. How can you describe that a little bit? And how do you think that's different than male competitiveness? Because obviously we've got it too,
yeah,
but there's
yeah,
a
yeah.
difference. There's a different flavor.
Ooh, okay, this is going to get interesting. I don't know what goes on inside of male psyche, but I do know that we are all living within a patriarchal paradigm. And I want to be very clear about how I define patriarchy. I do not define patriarchy as the tyranny of men. I do not believe you're my oppressor. I don't believe any men here are my oppressors. But I do believe for thousands of years, and this is actually factual, we have believed in a male patriarchal God that rules above the earth. When before the rise,
we call God he. Most people call God
right,
he.
Yeah. In the Western world. Right. And so before that, like in the Neolithic and Paleolithic eras, we worship the goddess. And not just the goddess, a male and female. The goddess was the first, but there was always a male and female. And we understood that God, creation, was both above and within. And then comes the rise of the patriarchy. And I believe there was really important evolutionary reason for it. Some good things have happened from that type of thinking of like, oh, actually, you know, there's this thing we need to build. We need to work together to strive to be better, to accomplish. And then the idea of this like good versus evil and this God that is above but created everything below, but he is not the things below. He's somehow separate from. And we should strive to be like that because our inherent nature is sinful. This whole thing took place. And then the creation story of Adam and Eve actually was created. And Eve ate the apple, man. You know?
It was Eve's fault.
Eve ruined humanity. We were all eternally sinned and damned to not be in Eden anymore. And so this myth, this creation story, this myth really created a lot of skepticism of the feminine essence. And of course, women. And then you see this rise of these really strong warrior tribes. and this like masculine, like rawr, let's conquer, let's build. And you see this like shaming of like weak men, and weak meaning like more effeminate and like sensitive and compassionate. And you see women being owned by their men, subservient. And then the subjugation of nature. We now dominate nature. We now dominate animals. We're not a part of this living ecosystem. And so I believe that through this, competition was created to get to the top, to beat the evil and meet this high God who's superior to all of us, and to become superior in general, to become outstanding, which is an interesting word because in some indigenous tribes, the word outstanding is the closest thing to devil that they have in their language, to be away from the tribe. So anyway, all of this to say, I think about this question a lot. And I think for women specifically, we had to have a man to survive. We really did. Like, you couldn't own anything. It wasn't until the 70s in the United States that women could even own credit cards. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have the capacity to care for ourselves. And so we really needed the affection and lasting affection of a man. And if your two sisters in a village and there's one eligible bachelor, even those two sisters are going to compete against each other to survive. And so I think the competition thing comes from a lack consciousness, which I think somehow is connected to not understanding that God is both above and here now, and that we are all good and inherently good. And, you know, masculine and feminine polarities are essential to balance. Hmm.
So for guys, it's, I think we evolved to compete over resources, or right. Partly we wanted to be outstanding from a perceptual standpoint so that we got the finest woman, we got the, we had the most power in the mm-hmm. group, but also we needed to fight over resources.
Mm-hmm. To provide right. for the ones you loved, for the women you were in charge of.
Right. I heard someone talking about this recently, maybe Brett Weinstein. He was talking about how for males, it's very overt. Mm-hmm. Our forms of competition are very overt and you can see them, right? Mm-hmm. And with women, oftentimes they're more covert. Sneaky. Under the surface.
Yeah, we have learned to manipulate. Uh-huh. And that's one thing that I think women do very well and very unconsciously. I know I did. I was like, I knew how to manipulate. When I couldn't get what I needed, I would try to manipulate to get what I needed. And that didn't actually create the result that I needed. And it's taken a long time to unlearn that pattern. And first to get real with myself and be like, oh, wow, I manipulate. Whoa. You know? And to be honest about that and be like, okay. And then to also realize it comes from an innocent place and to love myself through that. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can de-shame men and de-shame women for the ways in which we perpetuate the wound, and we can all realize that that's all it is. It's a wound, and we're all in it together, and we have different polarities of that wound, then I think there's a lot of healing that can take place.
Can you talk a little bit about how competitiveness and like cattiness or any other big things that women deal with, how that affected your feeling of belonging?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was really bullied. I don't fully know why. For a long time, I had a lot of shame around it. I still have social anxiety that I deal with because of it, actually. So I don't exactly know why, but girls were just like really mean. I have guessed that they were jealous at times, and maybe in some cases they were. And then I've also guessed that I was needy. You know, I like, again, I needed attention. Mm-hmm. And I think that rubbed girls the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was one part, like I just had light and magnetism and beauty and athleticism and drive, which was threatening. And then another part is all of that was through a filter of needing attention. And so it was out of balance. And so it shaped who I was because I believed there was something inherently wrong with me. Like people couldn't like me. I mean, even this year, I cried about that. Like it's still something, even though I work with women, it's why I do what I do, mm-hmm. is because it's like a really important thing for me to learn that I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to be pleasing. I don't have to be small. Like I made myself small so women would feel big. And it was my way of surviving. And now I'm learning how to be everything that I am and not dim my light. In fact, this very cliche tarot card that or oracle deck card that I just pulled before this in your living room says, don't dim to fit in. And I was like, oh, that's me right there.
I love it. How do you think things like the new technologies are interfacing with what we're talking about? So phones, social media, how is that affecting either positively or negatively how you think women interact with each other?
Well, I can start with a positive because my business is fully about the positive. Through the internet and through the technology we have today, women are finding women that are like them. Mm-hmm. Women that are sensitive, women that are empathic, women that, you know, were the weird ones that talk to plants, you know, and women who have had, you know, mystical experiences but have been labeled crazy or woo-woo, or women who are seeking real relationships, or women who, like in India, who, you know, or Afghanistan, who can reach out to different women and actually like talk about things candidly. We have an amazing way for women to come together and remember who they are in each other's reflection and create a safe container for women to really express. And so in that way, it's awesome. And then I think social media and media in general is really distracting. I think it's confusing to navigate. Because not only are you trying to navigate your internal realm and your material life, now all of a sudden there's this like mental cyberspace that you're trying to navigate. How do I belong here? How do I measure myself up in this space when it's completely fabricated by us? We're completely making this reality up. Like we are literally creating these cyber spaces where all of a sudden like we have worth or we don't have worth, or, you know, and then especially like with the rise of Instagram and filters. Oh my God, filters. I have to admit, a good filter makes me feel really good mm-hmm. about myself, but ultimately I don't think I need to be feeding my own insecurity and feeding my own vanity. I think ultimately like gathering in person and seeing everybody's imperfections and loving people through their imperfections and actually loving them more because they're imperfect and having permission to not be perfect yourself is really, really where it's at. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I find social media especially to be sort of antithetical to connection because it's obvious why it, well, maybe it's not so obvious. I think in terms of competition, it really amps up a feeling of competition because we're only seeing the best parts of people right. and we're not seeing their struggles and their challenges like we would in person. And so even though I know that conceptually that, you know, so-and-so thought leader in an industry that I'm in, that I look up to, that he has flaws and challenges, et cetera. Even though I know that conceptually, my mind doesn't really get it. I just see this perfect person whose life is so much better than me or so much better than mine. And it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. It's been impossible for me at least not to constantly compare and compete on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've even gone as far as being like, man, that girl's more authentic than me on social media.
She's so real.
She's so real. Yeah. Yeah, it's a thing. I mean, I can't even imagine what, like, I didn't grow up with a cell phone until I was in high school, so I can't even imagine this next generation. But I do believe, and here's a plug-in for the work you do, I do believe more and more there's going to be a rebellion or a rising of sacred, intimate, connective, in-person experiences. Mm-hmm. especially now, I think they're already beginning, like, the need for it. When before, like, when Global Sisterhood first started, there was, like, this first initial wave. Women were like, yes, women's circles. Women's circles are now more known. And I think Global Sisterhood had a big piece in that, a big part to play. But they're more known now. But I remember in the beginning, like, after our initial first early adopters, we had to, like, kind of educate people about why it's even necessary. Because mm-hmm. people were more or less, like, content in their lives. But especially now that, like, so much in the world is shaking, there's so much unpredictability, there's mental health awareness is on the rise, mental wellness, which is more holistic in nature, is more a common thing we talk about, and people are feeling also isolated and lonely. Now it's like, we don't have to convince people that this is needed. People are looking for it. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh God, yes, that. To be met in person.
So what is a circle?
A circle can be anything, really. Do you want to know what a global sisterhood circle is?
Yep.
So basically imagine that you have anywhere from 5 to 50 women in a room together in a circle. And there's a facilitator who is, I guess, your leader. But the way we think of leaders isn't like top down. It's more like there's a facilitator and then everybody else is a collaborative participant. So we're all equal in a circle. And the one facilitating might have like an idea or for the theme. And for Global Sisterhood, we have themes. We have a theme for every new and full moon. And we align with the astrology of the moon so that there's like a potent energy of like which zodiac sign it's in. But there's a theme that's connected to it, but also really connected and really pertinent to a woman's evolution. So for instance, we have themes around like freeing the voice, learning to speak your authentic truth. We have themes around healing sexual wounds, sexuality, sacred sexuality. We have themes around masculine and feminine. We have themes around like sovereignty. So we have these themes that are really important to women, and women will guide a specific ritual. Usually it's a ritual that Global Sisterhood provides, but often women like to create their own, but they'll create it within the theme. And so the idea behind Global Sisterhood is we train women how to lead women's circles, but then they're leading it on the same night with thousands of other women's circles at the same time. Wow. So there's like a potent synchronistic energy. And we don't want to like be dogmatic about that. You can do whatever you want if you're trained by us. And women want to be a part of something that's collaborative and something that's amplifying, like we have our microcosm of our own circle, and then we have this like global movement of women having these same conversations. Like for instance, maybe 3 years ago, I was leading a circle in Austin, and we were talking about freeing the voice. We're talking about like what was interesting to us here in Austin was about like our creative expression, like being able to like, you know, express who we are in the world. And I knew based on like who was circling via Global Sisterhood that we had a circle in Afghanistan that was circling.
Wow.
Afghanistan. And they're talking about freeing the voice. And I remember just like having this moment of like, wow, we're talking about expression. They're talking about life and death, you know? And that was a really moving moment that I'll never forget, realizing that while I was in that circle. And so basically it's not just talking, it's meditation and ritual, and not just ritual. That's like, we're calling it's not culturally appropriated ritual. We're not like calling in the elements and, you know, doing any of that. We're doing like,
which is more of a Native American
practice. Yep. If there's a Native American circle facilitator, she can definitely use the resources she has, but we're really careful to actually just like do things that are universal, and then people can add in their own heritage and their own origins, because we all have indigenous roots. Mine are Celtic, you know, so I have a little bit of a Celtic flair in my belief system and in my traditions. But we lead rituals that are designed to have women to look inside and to be guided into places that they wouldn't normally go unless they were in this setting. And then once they go into this setting and they have these understandings or these experiences, then they're sharing and debriefing. And that's when the real deep stuff takes place and transformation takes place. And we've had women say that circles in the Global Sisterhood are like 10 years of therapy in one, because it's experiential, not just talking. and because you're being witnessed and held. And that right there is so therapeutic.
So there's like a symbolic part of the event at the beginning, like the ritualistic part of it, and a...
Yeah, there's like an official opening, mm-hmm. and maybe a little meditation. And then there's the facilitator might share about the topic. People might discuss it a little bit. There might be some questions. And then there's a ritual. And that ritual is like a good chunk of the circle. It's like a inner work exercise of sorts.
Got it.
And then there's like, you might do that in partners. You might do that by yourself. You might do that with the whole group. And then there's a sharing afterwards. Mm-hmm. There's usually like a little movement practice or a breathwork practice or something. And there's all sorts of little flares that facilitators put in that are their own. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious your thoughts on this for people that are listening to this that want to try this, but don't have the training, don't have any of that, but want to maybe interested in facilitating a deep discussion for a group of their friends or their family. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the key ingredients? And what I'm thinking is, you know, there are different roles in a circle. There's the facilitator, there's the person that's speaking at any given moment, and then there's the listener, like the role of listening who, you know, everyone that's not speaking is in. What are some of the keys of each of those?
Well, there's guidelines. And so we have a set of guidelines that we teach our facilitators to always speak at every circle so that each person feels safe. And so if someone's going to be facilitating a conversation that's a bit deeper, a little bit difficult, it's really important to establish some guidelines that everybody agrees to so that everybody feels like they can share their truth and be accepted. One very easy one is, here we practice non-judgment. And if you have the urge to judge someone, the practice is to reflect it back to yourself and observe what you need to heal and integrate that's creating that judgment. And so that's number one.
I feel like that won't be obvious to everyone, what you just said, the reflect back to yourself.
Yeah.
What's an example of why that might be useful?
To examine your own triggers. So what is a trigger? A trigger is a really important biological function that shows us where we have trauma. And trauma is basically any negative experience that's not integrated in your body, that still exists in your nervous system, an uncompleted story. And so a lot of our triggers and our judgments are pointing to unintegrated trauma inside of ourselves. And so having a trigger and being really like annoyed with somebody or judgmental of somebody is showing you a path inward. If you follow that trigger backwards into yourself to see, like, okay, why am I judging this person? Why am I so upset about this? What's this pointing to? And you learn how to navigate and kind of go a little bit deeper out of blame and into inquiry. Mm-hmm. Then you can see the ouchie and learn to take care of the ouchie and integrate the pain.
I've got a great example of this. I was bird hunting a couple years ago, and I could hear my cousin talking to the guide, the hunting guide, while the rest of us were hunting. And I noticed what was going on in my head was a lot of judgment towards my cousin. And it went like, oh, that motherfucker just like sucking up to the guide. He's always like looking for attention, blah, 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 blah. And then the next thing that I noticed was that I was simply just jealous. I was jealous at his ability to connect and strike up a conversation with anyone. He's just so incredible at it. And I noticed that jealousy. And once I did that, I just felt this huge release in my body. Like all of the tension that I had in my chest and that I was holding against him just kind of dissolved when I made it more about me and not about something he was doing wrong.
Right. Right.
So you're inviting people with this first principle or first guideline to tune in, to notice things like that.
Exactly. Because that's really ultimately what heals us. It's not just being accepted. It's also noticing where we are not accepting others, because that points to where we're not accepting ourselves. And I mean, if we all practice this all the time, like macro, like in political conversations and all those things, we would be in a completely different place. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that sometimes people didn't do something wrong. People could have done something wrong that you're like, ooh, that was not, I wouldn't have liked that. They shouldn't have done that. That might be true. And there's always a way to, there's always a way to assess, you know, what's yours in the situation and to own what's yours. Mm-hmm. And that makes facilitating conversations, if every person is agreeing to that, much simpler.
I love that. What's number two?
Number two is confidentiality. This is really important. And especially in like an intimate setting where like people might know people, you know, what is shared in circle stays in circle. Mm-hmm. And if you're, something is really impactful to you, what somebody said, and you want to share it, you ask for permission and you never use their name. You say, I was sitting in a circle and this woman said, and you only do that with permission. And yeah, that's really important. Another thing, which is a lot like the third principle, which is a lot like the first one, is deprogramming biases. So we live in a culture where no matter who we are, what color our skin is, what religion we practice, where we grew up, what our socioeconomic background is, we have basically indoctrinated biases. And that goes for every single one of us. We can be really, really good people and we have that. And so in circle, especially in global sisterhood, because we have women from all over the world with different countries and different like spiritual beliefs, all the things, we practice deprogramming our biases, our racism, our judgments, which feels a little bit different than examining your own triggers. It's more like cultural deprogramming.
So maybe an example of this is America. We have a very individualistic society, and most of us believe that freedom and independence and doing our own thing is of the highest good. Like that's the most important value that we could have. And a lot of Eastern cultures have a more collective value set. They find it more valuable to do what's in service of the whole rather than the individual. Neither of them are right, in my opinion, but we tend to think our way is the right way. And so if we're in a circle with other people, that could influence how we perceive what other people are saying.
Right, exactly. And we may look down upon somebody. For instance, like another good example is like a woman who chooses to wear a hijab, you know, like a woman who's like super feminist in the United States might think that woman is oppressed, and that woman might feel really, really empowered. Mm-hmm. And so this cross-cultural barrier, we try to prepare people to, when they come against it, to unlearn it and to respect people and have trust in people.
All of these things about noticing judgments and biases, how do you do that? How do you do that in your body and in your mind?
Well, you start with our fourth guideline, which is active listening. So sometimes when you're in a circle or like when you're being interviewed or when you're having a conversation with friends, I do this all the time. I don't even realize it, but I'm preparing for the next thing I'm going to say. It takes us out of the present moment and it brings us into our own self-absorbed reality. And in a circle, we practice. And even if you know you're going to be speaking next, you just practice being completely in the present moment. And so if you're practicing being completely in the present moment, really fully listening with your whole body to what a woman's saying, you'll notice when something twinges. You'll notice when something shifts, there's a tightening. And then you'll notice that there is like a thought pattern or a thought form that comes with that body sensation. You trace that. You're like, okay, this feeling in my chest made me feel unworthy here, made me feel angry here, made me feel like, ugh, I can't believe she said that. And then you trace it.
Beautifully said. And I believe that when you're first beginning this practice of active listening, the vast majority of the time, you won't even notice any of these things. You'll just be caught up in them. And that's okay, because we've been conditioned our whole life to do this. And so it can take some time to have this come into our awareness more often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Still in the practice for sure.
So those are great. So this is something that a facilitator can do to set a great container and a really make it safer for people to really open up.
Right. And then what makes a really good facilitator is when somebody is not within the guidelines, how to speak to it without singling that person out and making them wrong. And that's the real skill.
Tell me more about that.
It's a challenge.
I'll tell you this. On soul searching adventures, I have a number of principles that I rattle off, and a couple of them are so similar. It's like practice spontaneity, speak from the heart, exactly like a couple of what you just said. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what I do is if someone breaks them, I, as gracefully as possible, point it out to them in the moment. And so I'm really curious your thoughts on not making it about them and that whole thing.
Well, you can, depending on the type of thing. Like, for instance, like if a woman is rambling on and not really speaking from a centered place or something, you could say, excuse me, you know, like I can interrupt her. Especially I'm thinking of, like, I've been doing a lot of virtual spaces. It's harder in virtual spaces, but like, excuse me, I really want to feel what you're saying. Can you slow down and take a few deep breaths and speak from your heart? Mm-hmm. You know, like really showing I'm really interested, but you're not translating to me what you're trying to.
Got it.
So something like that.
So you're not just giving critical feedback and leaving her with that. You're very gracefully inviting her to actually be following the guideline.
Yes, yes.
And showing her that you're still interested in hearing what she has to say.
Yes. And luckily, I haven't had many experiences where I've had to protect the entire group from a woman. You know, in normal circles, for instance, like you have 10 women, it's very unlikely you're going to have to go through some of that stuff, but maybe you will. Maybe a woman is, you know, emotionally unstable or something like that. But sometimes we have circles or events that have, like, you know, our last one had 500 women virtually, and that becomes more of like a, you never know what you're gonna get when you call on somebody to speak, right? So sometimes you have to intervene and shift the energy, like, for the well-being of the entire container. Mm-hmm.
And as a facilitator, it takes skill and courage. It takes courage to actually call someone out. Mm-hmm. And it takes skill in doing that in a way that not only protects the group, but the person you're calling out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So what about things as a speaker or as a listener? What are some other ways to, like, get the most out of and be most supportive in a group?
What type of group? A facilitated group or like a deeper conversation facilitated by a friend?
I would say more the latter.
Okay. So like in your average day, like wanting to...
Yeah. Let's say like what I envision is, if people are interested in this, them facilitating a group conversation of people sitting in a circle.
Cool.
It doesn't have all of the elements of what you're talking about, cool, but it has the deep discussion piece.
Cool. Yeah. So first you need everyone's consent, period. Like, everybody has to want to be doing that. And then once everybody wants to do that, like, come up with some guidelines, have everybody agree, give their 2 cents. And then I think it's really important to get out of the head. So whether that's a brief breathing or presencing exercise, or just like, you can call it a slow minute. And just close your eyes and breathe for a minute, like time it, and just everybody slow down their breath and breathe for a minute. And then when you pose the prompt or the question, have everybody really feel into their bodies before speaking, and like, how does their body feel? And like, really feel the feelings that they're feeling more than the thoughts that they're thinking, and speak from the feelings. That's what I would advise.
Yeah, that's really great. And a really easy way to do this, if you're not experienced in guiding meditations or things like that, is just put on a YouTube video or an app, do a little 5 or 10 minute guided meditation, and it just gets you out of your day-to-day worries and responsibilities and allows you to really tune into what your body's feeling and speak from the heart.
Yeah, that reminds me of this really cool exercise. It's called the head bubble exercise. And basically it shows you the difference between being in your head all day, which we are, and the way you communicate and the way you think and the way you process information when you're in your head, and then getting lower into your abdomen, your lower dantian area, and what happens to the way you communicate, the way you process information, and also to the way you're received when you're like rooted there. It's a really interesting exercise. So
sounds great. Is it like too complicated to explain?
Probably too complicated for this, but if you need an anchor to get out of your head, feel like a couple inches below your navel and feel your feet on the ground and like move your energy down low.
Mm-hmm. One of the telltale signs that you're speaking from the head and from your intellect is we tend to use more words. We tend to speak faster and we tend to make less sense to
people. It's really true.
And when we speak from the heart, when we speak from our experience, we're slower, we're more concise, and people just feel like they can connect to us while we're talking.
Yeah.
And it just really makes sense.
Yeah. Still a learning process for sure. Because mm-hmm. I feel like when I get anxious, I revert to my head. You know what I mean? Like if I'm like overstimulated, I revert to my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I get nervous. And so sometimes I revert to my head. I remember whenever I like watch recordings of me talking or something, I can tell when I'm in my head and when I'm in my body, and I have this like, oh man, get in your body, Lauren, get in your body. It makes such a difference. Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit like rubbing your belly and patting your head, but another amazing tool is just to try to stay connected to your breath while you're speaking. It can be difficult again, but if you can bring some level of awareness to breathing through your nose, taking big, deep breaths while you're speaking, that helps a lot as well.
Mm.
And then how about as a listener?
Same. Breathe, listen, be present, feel your body. I think it's the same. I don't think you always need to make eye contact. The Yawanawa or Yawanawa, some call it.
Yawanawa.
They, when they're listening to what someone has to say, they bow their head and do not make eye contact. They like bow their head to their heart. They close their eyes and they feel what the person is saying. They don't look at the person. And so sometimes I try to do that, to like really receive through my heart what the person is saying.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. What does feminine leadership mean to you?
Well, it's more than just women in power or powerful positions like politics or corporations or government. It's about leading a feminine way, but not just like without masculine qualities, not without like our traditional type of leadership, but in balance with intuition and receptivity and fluidity and collaboration. I would love to see a world where women could be in a boardroom and be like, oh, you know what, guys, this is a really great plan and everything, but it just actually doesn't feel right in my body. It just doesn't, it's something feels off, and have people look at that woman and be like, okay, let's listen to this, you know? So women who are courageous enough to do that, not necessarily in a boardroom, but at home with their families or with each other or with their partners, to just really say, hey, I have a feeling about this, and trust in your feelings. And this brings me to a topic where I don't think women or men always know how to trust in their feelings. I think because feelings have been lumped in with the whole like feminine, like suppression of the feminine. So suppression of feelings and the validity of feelings. I think because that's happened for so many years, we are emotionally immature. I think we don't really understand how to navigate our feelings. I think we're learning, but I think sometimes feelings aren't trustable because we don't know what they're telling us. So
hard to measure.
Impossible to measure. Mm. Like, can't be quantified. But to learn how to navigate your own internal world so you know what you feel and know how to listen to it and know how to listen to your feelings without blaming other people or making other people wrong, but how to trust your feelings and trust your intuition and trust your inner voice. To me, that's feminine leadership. And I believe men can embody that too. Mm-hmm. And to have the courage to stand in it, even if it makes no rational sense. And that's the most important part, to learn how to wield your emotions and understand yourself so well and be emotionally mature that you can trust in your feelings and your gut intuitions and stand by it for not just yourself, but for your family and for humanity as a whole. I think feminine leadership is really about birthing the next generation too, even if you're not going to be a mother, like an actual mother that bears a child, but to enter into a phase where you're mothering the world. You know, you are bringing your intention for the way you want the world to evolve into everything you do.
And does that mean you are, so when I hear mothering, the first word that comes up is nurturing. Does that resonate with you?
It's part of it. But no. Yes. Yes. Nurturing.
Yes, but no.
Yes, but no. Not the whole picture. Like, I think what I mean is nurturing what you want to see blossom. So the types of energy, the types of interactions, the type of healing, the things you, the seeds you want to plant, nurturing those. But then also being fierce and standing in your truth when something is actually destructive to the nurturing of those seeds you planted. Mm-hmm. But not
like a mama would protect her young.
Yeah, but not the type of fierce that is coming from the victim wound that blames everybody else. The type of fierce that calls people in, right? That says, hey, I believe in you. This is not acceptable. I'm not going to shame you. I'm going to call you to rise. And what do you need for that? You know, what do you need to rise? I'm not going to necessarily provide it for you, but I can hold space for you to figure it out. Mm-hmm. But not casting people away anymore. Mm-hmm. But I want to make a caveat. If you are in a relationship that is dangerous, cast that person away. It's okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you identify with this concept that David Data talks about? So David Data wrote Way of the Superior Man and a couple others for those who don't know him. One thing that he talks about is a feminine quality is emotions changing like the weather, right? A woman can be certain in her feeling about a big decision in her life one moment, and then a couple of days later have a completely different feeling. And it's not that she was lying at any point. She just genuinely feels differently about it. Do you identify with that?
100%. Though less distinct like that. Like, it's very rare that I'm like full yes to a big decision and then 3 days later against it. Mm-hmm. That's a very rare experience for me. I think that through studying yourself, those types of quick turnarounds become less and less.
Got it.
But in the sense that one day I'm like, wow, I love everything. I'm feeling so grateful. Everything's perfect. And then waking up the next day being like, the house is cluttered. My relationship needs work. What is happening in my life? I mean, that is a real thing. And there's an intelligence to it. It's not that everything's falling apart and my life sucks and my relationship's falling apart, but it is my emotions guiding me to look at something that's suboptimal to learn how to,
very well said,
learn how to be like, how do I elevate this and bring this into my awareness, into the awareness of my loved ones so that we can work on this together? But where it goes wrong with our emotional immaturity is we think it's totally true. We're like, everything sucks. And we get in a fight with our partner and we like, whatever. And so it takes a lot of restraint and practice to not do that and to understand that this is inviting me into a deeper look and then to gracefully invite my partner or my family into this evolution with me.
So well said. I never looked at it like that. It's like, Yeah, you need the intensity to actually look at what you're feeling shitty about, right? Because for me, I could be subtly unhappy for months about something, whereas a D, she would be triggered so much more quickly.
Right.
And so if we think about it in the context of a family or a partnership, the more masculine trait is sturdiness. And so I can use my example with a D, like she may all of a sudden have a story about like something is so wrong with our relationship. And she just feels terrible about it. She feels like I'm being so neglectful. It's so intense for her, which is not entirely true that I'm being that neglectful, but the intensity of that feeling for her has her bring it up. And then in my sturdiness, I can help ground her. And then also listen to that feeling that she's having, not brush it off as, oh, she's just being a crazy woman, but trusting the power of her intuition. And then together we integrate that and learn from it.
Mm-hmm. You are a beautiful man. That is exactly right. Well done. And she's very lucky to have you.
Thank you.
The sturdiness is important, mm-hmm. to not like get all ruffled. Even though it's really easy to want to get ruffled by a woman's storm, mm-hmm. and to not call her crazy. I cannot tell you how many times I feel like I've been called crazy in my life. And there's things that I have experienced that categorically could be considered crazy, but have been very real for me and very important for me. And to have a man who can stabilize and hold space for my crazy, my mm-hmm. quote unquote crazy, which isn't crazy at all, is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. So bringing it back to feminine leadership, you were talking about your vision of a woman standing in a boardroom and she intuitively feels like a decision is incorrect. And your vision is that the group would really value that. If there's some element of femininity that can change really quickly, how does that interact with let's say it's like a really big business that's all moving in a direction and every decision is really massive
and calculated and data driven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you marry the two? Yeah. And you know, this business has all of these families that are being supported by its growth. And so I guess part of this is just coming from a concern of a feminine leader making a decision that maybe she doesn't fully understand yet, or she may change her mind really quickly. What are your thoughts on that?
I think this is such a great question and probably one of the quintessential issues between integrating the feminine genius into the corporate world. So I think it's a matter of values. So in this case, the values of this company is to make the best calculated decision so that it makes more money, it keeps going, and it supports its employees and its shareholders, etc. Mm-hmm. But
which is the by far the most typical value.
Right. Right. That's the value of business in general. But what if the woman's feeling can't be measured? She can't prove it, but for some reason it's something that will protect the environment. But you can't know this yet. You know what I mean? You can't know that there's something flawed in the plan because it might have a repercussion that you can't see. Mm-hmm. Like, do we want to continue to build and build and build and gain and gain and gain? At what cost? Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think in that situation, even if it makes no sense, to pause, just be like, okay, you know, yes, time is money, but we can afford to like think about this. Mm-hmm. Just give it a pause, just to honor the pause. And have everybody just think, mm-hmm. feel. Because I feel, I believe that we haven't left room for feeling in business, you know? And I think that's part of the reason why we have these massive corporations that are really destructive. Mm-hmm. They don't mean to be. They're providing a service, but how valuable is that service compared to our coral reefs? You know what I mean? Or to whatever thing they're sacrificing. And I think there's some really big, complicated questions that I don't have the answers to. But I think a more integrated approach where feelings mattered all around could only be a good thing.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think it's about integration of feminine and masculine qualities. So decisiveness and direction and vision along with feeling and sensing and
surrender.
And intuition.
Yeah, and surrender. Like I think listening too. Like not listening to people necessarily, but listening to our conscience or your spiritual power without your own gain in mind. Like what's needed? What's wanted? Mm-hmm. You know, to surrender in that way.
Yeah. And that may or may not be better for the bottom line, but it seems like a better approach for the planet, the right. Like the world.
Right.
The people in it, the animals, the way that we feel and communicate with each other, mm-hmm. It certainly feels like a better way.
Right. And so we have a lot of hard choices to make in that regard. Do we want to just increase the bottom line? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to create sustainable companies and sustainable ways of living that are better for the whole? Mm.
Well, this has been great. In closing, I'm curious. You know, you're a very sensitive person and there is a lot of chaos going on in our world right now. What are some of the key practices or things that you're doing in your mind or your body that are helping you stay grounded and not be just constantly thrown around by all of the shit that's going on right now?
Well, I think the most obvious is to disconnect from electronics and go outside. And not just go outside and put on your headphones and listen to electronic music or a podcast, but to go be silent in nature, to feel. My friend, who's an acupuncturist, once taught me that when I enter a forest or when I enter into a beautiful natural place, to say, "Hello, forest, I'm here. I ask for permission to enter." And literally ask the forest for permission. And then when you walk in, say, "Thank you. I ask that you help me renew my chi." And the chi as like your energy or life force. And so as you're walking, be in like feeling awareness to the trees and to the plants and to the animals and let it replenish you. So walks in nature are really good for this. Forest bathing. A practice I have recently for the past few months that I've loved. And a lot of indigenous people do this, but particularly indigenous women have this practice of praying to the waters. So it's been really awesome. Every morning I fill up a pitcher of water and I say some prayers for the protection of the waters, for the protection of the seas and the rivers, and also for clean water for everyone to drink. But then I speak to the water as if the water had a consciousness of its own. And I say things like, "Give me clarity. Help me feel peace in my body. Give me good health." And then I all day long drink that water. And I try to slow down when I drink it. It's been a really good ritual for me.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Where can people find more about you?
They can find me at globalsisterhood.org.
All right. Thank you again.
Yeah.
Bye, y'all.